I have known David Gordon since Westminster Seminary days in the late 70s. David and I happened to be classmates, class of 1979. We didn't know each other very well while we were in seminary, but now, since we moved back to New Hampshire in 1992, Dave and Diane and the girls have become very close to us, and I would count David among my best friends over the years. We've been through thick and thin together in a way, and just have hit it off on a number of different levels, along with our theological commitment to historic Presbyterianism. David is presently a professor of religion and Greek at Grove City College, where for almost 8 years he's taught courses in religion, Greek, humanities, and a subject that's fairly unique to us, and one of the things that we share an interest in, media ecology. And if you don't know what that means, you will over the next hour. Also, prior to that, he was here in New England, and that's where we really established our friendship for 13 years, Gordon Conwell Seminary, and he taught there as a full-time professor. And while he was also a full-time pastor for 9 of those years at Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashua, New Hampshire. And then also he's contributed, David is a scholar, in my estimation, and I'm prejudiced, but really of the first order. He really is someone who knows his Greek New Testament and understands the history of commentary on the New Testament, and has contributed, therefore, to several study Bibles, New Geneva and the Reformation study Bibles and the Gospel of John. And then he's written numerous articles in various journals in our circles. I keep prodding him to publish some of the things that I know he's been working on for years, but he takes John Murray's approach and doesn't really want to publish things until he's really refined them and he can add something new to the discipline that he's writing about, and I admire that that instinct in him. He is also the husband of Diane and the father of their daughters, Grace and Dabney. And so without further ado, I probably already over-introduced you, David, but it's a great privilege to have you here, brother.
Thanks, great. It really is great to be back in New England. Normally when I come back, it's to hike in the great mountains up here. And I normally get back once in the winter to a snowshoe in Vermont, and once in the early summer to hike in the Presidential Range up here in New Hampshire itself. And it's always great to be back. And if you have the handout that Greg distributed, divided into lectures 1, 2, and 3, that's a structure of the weekend, but I can't promise that each lecture will conform to that. The first lecture, in many ways, is foundational to the other two. And if we don't complete it tonight, then we'll pick it up tomorrow. And it's fairly important for us to understand how that relates to the other two. And so I hope you'll be flexible with that as we go along. You'll note that the title is the Reformed Worship in the Electronic Age. And what that does for me is it combines two interests of my own, both personally and academically. Personally, in terms of God's calling, and academically in terms of my studies, I'm interested in liturgy and worship on the one hand. Alan and I have interacted on this for probably 12 or 15 years, in fact, and Greg and I for perhaps more years than that. But then I'm also very interested in the cultural question of how, when a culture's dominant media's shift, how that changes cultures and how that changes individuals. And then Greg and I have interacted on that a good deal over the number of years because his D-Min thesis dealt with this very issue. I have a very small handful of friends in the world that I can talk with who are cognizant of both liturgy and media ecology. And so this weekend allows me to pull into focus two issues that very rarely do we have people interested in both. And so I say that in part as an apology because some of you are very interested in worship, some of you very interested in electronic media, and I don't know if any of you are interested in both. But I am, for better or for worse. And I survived stage 3 cancer 2 years ago, and so for better or for worse, I'm still living, and there you have it. And so that's what we're going to deal with. And so we're going to deal with how we as worshiping Christians in an electronic media-dominated culture worship differently or the same way as the church has for its last 2,000 years. We're going to try to give some perspective on that that enables us to be better worshipers, richer worshipers, and more faithful worshipers in the future. And when I do conferences, it has been my opinion through the years, for better or for worse, rightly or wrong, I'm not defending it now, that the purpose of a conference, as opposed to your regular everyday preaching and teaching, which Alan and Greg and Steve and others do through the week, the purpose of a conference, Ray Coffey preaches every week, the purpose of the conference is to raise questions we may not settle that weekend. It's to stimulate our thinking for a period of time where, as Christian people, we can think about things for the next 2, 3, 4 years. And so I may raise questions this weekend that I don't answer. Jim will ask questions that I can't answer. In fact, we know that. And so that's intentional, perfectly legitimate to do that. And so what we'll have to look at tonight is how electronic media, as part of the environment that are part of our culture, shape us as worshipers. What are the individual effects on us? What are the cultural effects on us as people who grew up in electronic media culture? And you know, you don't have to step back but 2 generations to dissipate from it. My grandfather, who was born in the late 1890s, didn't have television until he was 70-some years old, which meant his life habits were formed before he ever had it. And by the time radio appeared, he was 30 or 35. So in many ways, his adult life habits were formed before the radio was there. What you and I take for granted as recently as 80 years ago wasn't even there. And media ecologists, as we shall see, the term is given for those people who study that, deal with that reality. So if you look at your first point on your Roman medium, there it says media as environment ecology. There's a term, it's a horrible term in some ways, coined by our friend who wrote Amusing Ourselves to Death, Neil Postman. Somewhere in the mid-1980s, Neil Postman coined the term media ecology. That's one of the most unattractive expressions I've ever heard, right? Nothing makes you want to jump up and down and, oh, media ecology. And say, why was a smart guy like Neil Postman, and he was a smart guy, he just died 2 years ago in October, why did he coin this term? And the answer was, ecology deals with environment. And he wanted to call attention to when shifts in media occur, how that changes the human environment. What's it like to grow up in a world before people wrote anything? A purely oral culture where all the wisdom of the culture was passed along word to mouth. Which meant if you didn't know wise people, you had no access to wisdom. And then when they started etching things out on animal skins, and very few people could own them, how did that change things? And then when in the 15th century they invented the printing press, where they could bang stuff out on cheap paper and publicize what was printed, how does that change things? And then when they developed the camera in the late 19th century and make images reproducible the way words had been before, how does that change things? And when teletype comes up with Morse code and you can send electronic stuff over wires from Boston to Texas in seconds. How does it change things? Media ecology was the term that Neil Postman coined to describe how we talk about the effect of those changes in media on humans and on human cultures. And so what we're trying to address this weekend is how are we as worshipers affected by those realities, and how do we make the best of them to become good worshipers? How do we avoid the worst of them to avoid being bad worshipers? That's what we're trying to get at. And so the outline has helped us to address that reality. Environmental changes are never additive. And that's why McLuhan, Postman used the word ecology. When you add the mountain lion to New England forest, it's not the forest it was before plus a mountain lion, because it eats things that were there before and they're not there. It's ecological. When you put something into an environment that wasn't there before, it's not the same environment plus something. It's a different environment. About 4 years ago, when I was driving up to hike in the fall, coming across the Kankamagas, as I descended on towards the east side, something ran across the road about 70 yards in front of my truck. Now I drive a Mustang GT. In those days, it was a truck. It was about the size of a German Shepherd, but ran with the gait of a cat. And it was kind of a light tan. Probably 60, 65 pounds. I'd never seen anything like it. I saw my friend Greg Gordon a few days later over in Jefferson, New Hampshire. I said, "What was it?" He said, "Oh, that's a mountain lion. They've come back to New England." And he says, we've confirmed it with both the tracks and scat and so forth, and there's no question we've got mountain lions here now. And a couple of years ago, not this year, but the previous year, would have been the winter of 06, when we were hiking in, snowshoeing into the cabin in Vermont, where Greg Reynolds and friends of mine have been doing it for a number of years. I was on the front of the trail, and I saw, going through the snow in front of me, a track that was clearly a cat track and not a dog track, but probably 3.5 inches to 4 inches broad, and unquestionably a cat and not a dog track. And I talked to Greg about it. He said, "Yeah, it's a mountain lion. Never saw it with my eyes. I did see one without tracks, and once I saw the tracks and not the cat." Now, that changes everything. It's a predator. And once that cat is in there, it will eventually change the whole environment. It won't be the old environment plus a cat. It'll be a different environment, because it will kill species that were there before, and it will kill species that ate those species, right? It'll change everything. So the theory of ecology is that when you introduce a new thing into an environment, it doesn't just add to the environment, it changes the environment. And that's why Postman thought it was necessary to call it media ecology. When media change from oral cultures to manuscript cultures to typographic cultures to electronic cultures to telegraphic cultures and so forth, how does it change the whole environment in which humans experience being human? And that's what we're addressing. And so to address that, your second Roman numeral is a matter that we want to talk about some definitions, because that affects us for the whole weekend. We're used to the word sense. We are not at all used to the word sensoria. That's why I have it in quotation mark. We are, to a lesser degree, used to the word sensibility. But in English, American English, not much of that. The senses, the term sense refers to the five senses: sight and hearing, smell and taste and touch. And all human beings who are healthy have all five senses. Sensibility adds two things to those five. Sensoria. Media ecologists add to those five things two mental properties. And from time eternal, the mind has been understood as having two properties, the rational property and the creative property. Rationality and imagination, you might say. I think in our day and age they call it left brain, right brain, don't they? But the point is, the mind pulls together these five senses and does things with them. It does rational things with them, where it says, that's a crazy idea. And it does imaginative and creative things. Maybe we could make a bridge this way versus that way, right? And so the mind, combined with the five senses, are called sensoria by media ecologists because they are the seven things by which we experience and process the world in which God made us. Imagine having the five senses, but not having a mind that could distinguish a good idea from a bad idea, or a mind that couldn't create a new way to build a bridge. The five senses wouldn't really work. Historically, the five senses have tended to be divorced from the two properties of the mind. Media ecologists have said the seven of them together we may call the sensoria, because they actually interact with each other, all seven. The creativity of the mind, the rational properties of the mind, as well as the five senses by which we feel things and hear things, right? And if you wanted to, taste things, I'm not interested, right? That if you didn't have all seven of them, you wouldn't really experience the created order the way God made it. And so those seven realities are called the sensoria together. And it, for the first time, really brings into combination the five senses with the two properties of the mind. Now, sensibilities, as we think of that term, is the cultivated use of the sensoria. That one person can say, it's going to rain. What do you mean it's going to rain? We're out here hiking. We haven't been able to check the news broadcast. What do you mean it's going to rain? Someone goes, it's going to rain. And he's cultivated his nose to smell the difference between a high-pressure system and a low-pressure system. And he can smell when it's going to rain. Or it might be, he says, uh-oh, it's going to rain. You go, I don't smell anything. He says, yeah, but I got this aching feeling in my knee. What does that mean? Well, it's a low-pressure system. Pressure's falling. And when the pressure falls, we're going to get rain, because the high pressure drives the clouds back up, low pressure lets them fall. And when the clouds fall, we're going to get rain. Ask Dave, he'll tell you that. We're going to get rain when the clouds are falling. So the sensibility is the cultivated use of the senses, where as we experience life, we learn what those senses teach us. Sometimes it's unwitting and unintentional, and sometimes it's intentional. But sensibility is the term we use in English language for the cultivated use of a sense or a sensoria, so that we understand things because we've cultivated their ability to work for us. Now, our point 2b is that the sensoria are flexible. If we were born in France, by the time we were 2 or 3 years old, our ear would hear French words and associate them with realities. Not because our ears were bigger or smaller than English ears or American ears, or cocked on our side, at the side of our head this way, right? But because the sensoria that God has given us, the five senses and the properties of the mind, are flexible. They're like a ball catcher's mitt. And if you take a mitt right out of the store and you put hard balls into it, before long, it catches hard balls well. But if you throw a softball, which is a bigger diameter, it drops them. Take the same mitt out there and throw softballs into it, and after a few days, it catches softballs well, but a hardball bounces right out off from the ground, doesn't it? The human sensoria and sensibilities are that way. They're flexible. that they adjust to what they're exposed to. And when they're accustomed to certain things with the ears and the eyes and the smell and so forth, they notice them. They tell us that people our age, Greg's and mine, would have a very difficult time learning Arabic languages because they apparently have glottal stops, consonants way back here in the lower throat, that are almost like incipient retching, they say. This is the kind of thing down here. And if you can't hear them and sound them in an early age, you probably can never do it. In other words, if it doesn't hit you in the first 18 years of age, you may not be able to do it. I don't know. Now, Greg's extraordinary, so maybe he could. But that's what they tell us. But ordinarily, those sensoria are flexible. And that's what accounts for that. A child who's 5 years old in France speaks French, and a child who's 5 years old in America speaks something approximating English. Right? The ears aren't different. The nose isn't different. The eyes aren't different. But their sensoria are flexible, and they embrace whatever they're exposed to. And they adjust to what they're exposed to. And they learn to hear and perceive what they're exposed to. That's very, very important, because what it means is this. What you and I can perceive in the future is determined in part by what we have perceived in the past. We're like a piece of clay that someone is shaping. And depending upon how they shape it, it may or may not receive other things in the future. And so the sensoria are flexible. They shape to what they're exposed to. The way, if you see trees as you've seen them probably, Jim, you've seen them, Steve, I know you've seen them. People who hike know that when you get up along tree line in New Hampshire and Vermont, the trees are always bending in a constant direction. And if we're lost because the whiteout comes in, all we have to do is look at those trees up at the summit. We know where we are because the prevailing wind is from the west. And those trees are always bending from the east to the west because that's the prevailing wind. They always bend in that direction. So from their root, they are west, and from their crescent, they are east. And whether you're looking at them from here, looking at them from there, that's the way they are. And that's where our sensibilities and sensoria are. They flex, they bend, and they adjust to their environment. And so we have ears to hear, but we hear what our ears have been trained to hear. We have eyes to see, but we see what our eyes have been trained to see. We have noses to smell, but we smell what our noses have been trained to smell. So we have tongues to taste, but we can only taste what those tongues have been trained to taste and so forth. We have fingers to feel, but if they've never felt certain things, they don't recognize it the next time. That's a very, very profound, profound reality in media ecology. Every perceptive act, therefore, cultivates one part of the sensoria or another. Every waking moment of life causes your ear to experience, or your eye to experience, or your nose, or your taste, or your touch to experience something, and therefore be more able to receive it the next time. That's the idea. And so if there are rich realities God has created for us to receive, it's almost like, is he broadcasting on AM and we've got a rusty AM antenna but a good FM antenna? Or is he broadcasting on FM and we've the converse? And so our capacities to receive can be actually shaped to receive what is the receivable. And if not, it's there, but we're blind to it or deaf to it. And then think of Isaiah's prophecy, isn't it? Go and say to these people, you will see and never perceive, and hear and never understand, lest you see with your eyes, hear with your ears, and turn with your heart, and I heal you. Their sensoria were deadened by sin and rebellion, so that even when God's prophet came to them, they did not see him as God's prophet. They did not hear him as God's prophet, and therefore their heart did not turn, and they were not healed. They had eyes, they had ears, but their eyes didn't see what eyes were made to see, and their ears didn't hear what ears were made to hear. So media ecology as a discipline says, how do we cultivate ourselves? You and I think of cultivating the world in terms of Genesis 1. Fill the earth, subdue it, exercise dominion over it. But we are also made in God's image responsible to cultivate ourselves, because only a well-cultivated image of God can cultivate the world. And so an uncultivated human cannot cultivate the world God gave us. And the question is, how do we cultivate that human? And our weakest concern is, how do we cultivate that human so it can worship? Because there are no neutral acts of the sensoria. Every time when Steve and I are hiking and Steve says, look over there, there's a lady slipper, because we saw some last year together. And if we stop and smell them, now we will notice next year with our eyes and our nose more quickly what we wouldn't have noticed the year before. Because we cultivate those perceptive faculties. So one of the things we wrestle with then is, how do the various media by which the human race has explored human experience, how do those not only give us insight into the world around us, but how do they also shape us? So historically, we look back at the 3 or 4 or 5 major moments here, and you have them on your outline, to the way the human race explored the world. Originally, it was oral. The way we communicated, the medium by which one human communicated with another was orality, voice. And a medium, that's what a medium is. A medium is something between one thing and another. So when we talk about media, that's just the plural of medium. A medium is just something between one human and another. It could be when I was 7 years old, my cousins lived next door, and we strung a piece of string across from our second floor to theirs, and we had a tin can on one side and a tin can on theirs and a button. And if you talked at it, the button would rattle and vibrate down the string and rattle on the other side, right? We thought it was very clever. It actually wasn't very efficient. Sometimes they just put the button and go, I said, do you want to go outside and catch fireflies? Right? But theoretically, the can would work, right? The can was a medium, and the string was a medium. Well, the first and enduring medium for all of humanity is orality. Many languages have never been written, never been reduced to writing. That's why Wycliffe is still in business. But all language that exists is spoken, and that is the fundamental and basic and primary medium. And oral cultures have certain characteristics to them. It shapes the perceptive capacities of human beings to be oral. It cultivates memory. Imagine a culture in which you can't write anything down or put it on your PDA. The most recent thing that's on mine, flying out of the Cleveland airport today, parked in long-term parking, first floor, green, section E, right? If I fly back this week and I want to find my Mustang, right? And at my age, I can't remember anything. And so we write it down. In this case, we just bang it in on the little keyboard, don't we? And in oral culture, you can't do that. And so among all the properties of the mind, what is necessary in an oral culture is memory. And so in oral cultures, everything when we communicate to each other is geared towards remembering it. And that's why at our age, we wish we were in oral cultures, don't we, Greg? Because it would help. Because we forget everything as we reach our 50s. Orality cultivates memory. Walter Ong said, in a primary oral culture, to solve effectively the problem of retaining and retrieving carefully articulated thought, you have to do your thinking in mnemonic patterns, shaped for oral recurrence. Your thought must come into being in heavily rhythmic, balanced patterns, in repetitions or antitheses, in alliterations or assonances, in epithetic and other formulaic expressions, in standard thematic settings, and proverbs which are constantly heard by everyone so they come to mind readily and which themselves are patterned for attention and ready recall or in other mnemonic form. Serious thought is intertwined with memory systems. Mnemonic needs determine even syntax. So you think about it, haste makes waste, right? That's memorable. It's put in a memorable way. My friends who smoke cigars with me, it's a terrible, horrible sin, but some of us think it's not so terrible and horrible, so we're still experimenting with it. And their cigar starts to burn a little bit long on this side, and it's not as long on this side. And so they get an uneven ash. And I say, long side, low. That's alliteration, long, low. Long side, low. Oddly enough, though heat rises, when you draft a cigar, when you puff it, the heat comes in from the bottom. And if it starts to burn unevenly, you have to put the long side on the bottom, not the top where you think heat rises, but on the bottom. And we say long side, low, long, low. That's called assonance, two L's, and it helps you remember that. In an oral culture, everything has to be preserved in a memorable form because you can't write anything down. And so of all the remarkable properties of the human mind in an oral culture, what it devotes itself to is memory. Because that's the only way one culture's wisdom can be passed on to another, is some in some memorable form. And so think of all of our proverbs, whether sacred or secular. It can be Ben Franklin's or those of the Holy Scripture. They're placed in this kind of memorable way because in an oral culture they have to be put that way. And the mind learns to perceive things that way. And that's why Socrates, of all people, believe it or not, objected to writing. You go, huh? The Socrates that we've read in books by Plato? He actually objected to writing. I myself disagree with him. I think writing overall has been a good benefit to the human race. But he was afraid it would kill memory. His fear was if you could write things down, you wouldn't cultivate memory. And so he was right in perceiving what might be lost by writing. I think he was wrong by not perceiving what might be gained by it. But Socrates, of all people, objected to writing. Now, by the way, here's a delicious irony. And if you are my age, you realize that one of the wonderful pleasures in life is cultivating a taste for irony. The only reason we know that Socrates objected to writing is his disciple Plato disagreed with him and wrote down his thoughts. So that's the only way we know that. So I enjoy irony, and if you do, you'll get a kick out of that one. So in oral cultures, you have to learn to use language in a way that's oral. And so there's all of the cliches and repetitions that make things work. And so if you go back and read through Homer's work, the Odyssey, it's the wine-dark sea, the rosy-fingered dawn, the golden-haired Diana, wine that gladdens the heart of man. And these expressions and epithets just occur again and again throughout the writing because it can't be distinct in every line. There have to be some stock phrases in an oral culture that you just depend upon. And repeat them again and again, because that's what carries the rest of it. And so one of the great characteristics of an oral culture is it cultivates memory. You realize, if my grandfather had something wise to say, I don't want to lose it. If my grandfather's culture had something wise to say, I don't want to lose it. And for us, it's hard to imagine a culture where you couldn't just write it down. But they couldn't write it down. They couldn't bang it into their keyboard. If you didn't have habits of memory, you lost it. And so repetition, what we call cliche, were part of that culture. It also cultivates community, because in an oral culture, you never read something in a binder like this. I mean, look at how impersonal that is, right? It's a black binder. And if we had reproduced this 30 or 40 times and given them out to you, you wouldn't know whether I gave it to you or Shaquille O'Neal, right? It's the same old black binder with white, black, and white paper. But in oral culture, everything you learn from another human being. And you know whether that human being is the wisest person in town or the most foolish person in town, right? And so if the wisest person in town says, well, save some money for a rainy day, you listen to that because that's a wise person. But if the person says, spend all your money, what's tomorrow? Well, those guys in the skids, right? And in a print culture, one of our deficiencies is we have these books containing ideas, and we have no perception of the person who communicates those ideas. Whether they have been responsible people throughout their lives, worked hard to be good, recovered when they weren't, we don't have that. We just don't know. That's why Paul Johnson wrote that great book, Intellectuals. And he traced some of the great contributors to Western thought since the 18th century and showed how debauched their lives were. He starts with Rousseau, which is easy pickings, who leaves his wife and children as orphans. The great lover of humanity teaches a political theory on love of humanity. And as they say, he never loved a single human being. And what they're basically saying is, Rousseau had no influence on people who knew him because his life was so obviously shameful. But for people who read him in books, his ideas can seem plausible. And oral culture protects you from that because you know the people who are telling you things. And if you're looking for business advice from a guy who's had one business after another go under, you take that differently from another person whose business has succeeded. If you're getting marital counseling from a pastor who's worked through his life through the years and had a successful marriage and reared children and they've got their own children, fine. Another guy who's been divorced 17 times and so forth, that's another thing. Well, on the other hand, you might have a guy who's divorced once, but he's learned from it. You might learn more from him than a guy who's never been divorced. But at least you know the person. You know where the counsel is coming from. In a book, you don't have any of that. Oral cultures give you information in a situation where you know the person who's bringing that information. It cultivates, in that sense, community. It also cultivates auditory attentiveness. Imagine that you're hearing something reputed to be someone reputed to be very wise in a culture where you can't write it down and you can't record it. And imagine how you would listen. I tell this to my students at Grove City about music. Before recorded music, and that's just very new. My dad's generation was the first that had recorded music. The first that had phonographic records. But imagine before that, just two generations ago, when the only chance you had to hear the Brahms Requiem is someone in Portsmouth or Boston is doing it. And you hear they're going to do the Brahms Requiem. You have one chance to hear it. You're not sure you'll ever get a chance to hear it in your life. And you would go, and you would sit in that seat, and you would lean forward, and you would be like Ross Perot, all ears. Right? Right? You would listen. As it is, we have our CDs. And in my case, two or three different recordings of the Brahms Requiem. Because, well, if I don't finish listening to it tonight, I can listen to it tomorrow or some other time. So we listen to music casually. because we can always have it again. But in oral culture, it's dynamic. And the person who's given you wisdom, an older gentleman, older woman, you listen to them because you may not get another chance at it. And it cultivates attentiveness, where in some sense, everyone is E.F. Hutton. And you're always leaning forward to hear, if Ian Hutton speaks, right, we listen. And so orality has that as a virtue to it. And it makes a different kind of human being. A human being that is attentive to orality and attentive to what you hear with your ears. We'll talk about this later this week because it's very significant for liturgy and worship and the reading and preaching of the Word of God. And when we pray our prayers of confession, and the minister says, if we confess our sin, He is faithful and just to forgive our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If our ears can't hear it, our souls can't profit from it. We have to have ears that can still register that. Not the thing that says, well, we'll record it and listen to it later. Right? In some sense, we need to be able to hear it and have souls that can hear, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up His countenance upon you and give you peace. And if that is said and there's no ears that can hear it, may as well not be said. Oral cultures, I think, could really participate in Christian liturgy. It cultivates a kind of auditory attentiveness because you can't say, I'll go back and get it later on the tape. Apparently, I'm alive right now. I had a 25% chance of living 3 years ago with my stage 3 cancer. My students were in one of two categories during that year. Some of them said, well, let's just wait him out and we'll beat him out and win anyway. Fortunately, they were the minority. The majority said, if this is his last semester, let's not miss out on our chance to catch him the last chance. There were some of them who realized that if he does die, the old rascal does die, let's not mess up the last chance to hear him. And so some of my students were more attentive than any students I'd ever had because I was obviously weak. I was 30 pounds lighter than I am right now. I didn't feel well. I was in a good deal of pain. And there was no guarantee that I would survive the cancer. Some of my students listened to me as students had never listened to me before. But in an oral culture, that's the way you always listen. Because you never knew if you'd get another shot. You couldn't record it. You couldn't put it on Memorex. You couldn't put it on BASF. You couldn't get an MP3. You either got it or you didn't get it. You had one chance, and then it was gone. And so for some of them, it would have been a great class to teach media ecology. The second major medium by which humans communicated was chirography. That's a big term, but chir in Greek is hand, and grapho is writing. And so the word chirography in Latin means manuscript, and in English means handwriting. Chirography means handwriting. At some point, people cultivated alphabets to translate the stuff we hear with our ears into something that could be written down. At that point, we become manuscript cultures or handwriting cultures. And what it does is it cultivates a certain kind of precision. When you're listening orally, you're trying to get the basic gist of it with some mnemonic devices to get the sense of it. But think of Paul's argument in Galatians when he says, regarding the promise made to Abraham in Genesis, through you and your seed, I will bless all the nations of the earth. Now, the word seed in Hebrew, zerah, is a collective noun, like our English word deer, D-E-E-R, where the plural and singular are the same form. We don't say deers, unless you're from West Virginia. That deer is either the singular or the plural. And zerah, seed, in Hebrew is the same way. So 3 centuries before Christ incarnated, when they translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek, the Septuagint authors, when they translated into Greek, had to choose whether the zera there should be taken as seed, spermasi in Greek, or seed, singular, spermati in Greek, dative singular, dative plural. And they translated dative singular, spermati, en to spermati sou, in your seed. And Paul calls attention to this. It does not say, he says, and to your seeds, en tois spermasi. But to your seed, en tois spermati, which is one, which is Christ. And Paul, on such a fine point of grammar as that, says they translated the Hebrew correctly and understood that the promise was not through every single one of Abraham's descendants, but through one of Abraham's descendants, God would bless the whole human race. I'm not sure an oral culture could do that. That is such a fine point, such a precise point, that it almost requires a writing culture to do it. And the good Lord, knowing what he was doing in the history of creation and redemption, revealed himself through various generations in various ways, in oral cultures, then writing cultures, Hebrew cultures, Greek cultures, and so forth, and apparently knew exactly what he was doing through each medium. Because there's a kind of precision that comes through handwriting that's not there in language. It cultivates, therefore, textuality. One of the most common recurring phrases in the Greek New Testament, or English New Testament, is, it is written, gegraptai. It is written. Not it is said, but it is written, gegraptai. The common way of introducing a passage from the Hebrew Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, is gegraptai, it is written. And it is as though certain things once said have canonical status. And even our sense as religious people of canonical status, in some sense, depends upon writing. Moses didn't come down saying, I think he said this, I'm not sure. First of all, he's darn angry with everyone, and so I'm a little confused right now. And well, for crying out loud, there was a lot of thunder up there and lightning, so I'm a little discombobulated right now. But I think the drift was, for crying out loud, be good and don't be bad. No, that's not what Moses said, right? The text says that these were etched by the finger of God into the stone, and preserving an actual textual record of the revelation of God. And that alters everything. It allows you to say later, it has been written, which couldn't be said in oral culture. And so written culture says there are certain ideas, truths, realities, prescriptions, proscriptions that a culture writes down and preserves forever. You go to the Lincoln Monument today, and in stone you have the Gettysburg Address. I respectfully disagree. I think the second inaugural is far superior to the Gettysburg, but the Gettysburg Address isn't bad. And note what we do as a culture. We inscribe it into stone. It is written. Right? There's something fixed about that that's not the case with orality. And so when God wishes to reveal himself to the human race, he fixes some of this stuff in writing. And that's what writing does. And so it cultivates this kind of a sense. Typography, what typography does, when we move to the 15th century and we can print stuff rapidly. By the way, the big genius in typography is not the mechanism of doing it fast. It's finding a cheap surface to write on. This was the great miracle of the 15th century. Not Gutenberg's printing press. It was being able to write on something cheaper than goat skin. The goat lobby wasn't at all interested in having a whole herd go through that thing. Right? So what the real thing was the combination of what the Chinese had already invented on how to impress this stuff on things, but cheap print. Now what that does is what is written as a culture's wisdom can be published for everyone and fairly inexpensively. Within 150 years of the printing press, Bibles are available and German and English and French. Virtually all over the world, so that virtually any family can afford one within a century and a half. And what only a scribe could have seen before, now everyone has access to. And so it makes a common stuff that you and I now take for granted. We've had books since we were children. We don't even think of them as a miracle, as it were. But to me, one of the most remarkable passages in the whole New Testament is Acts 8, where Philip sees the eunuch, and he's reading from a scroll of Isaiah. And he says, it says here, you know, that he was a man of sorrows and so forth, and he's acquainted with grief and this kind of a thing. And who's he talking about, himself or somebody else? And, of course, everyone else's mind but mine, because you all have normal minds. I have an abnormal mind. But all the normal minds say, well, it's a simple matter of the ratio of the Old Testament and New Testament. I'm saying, how in the world did he get a scroll of Isaiah? And the text tells us that how he got it, doesn't it? That he was basically the curator of the museum of the Queen of Egypt. Like someone today who might be working for MoMA in New York, the Museum of Modern Art, and have some Rembrandts there. They have a cocktail party. They take a couple Rembrandts home, hang them on their wall, right? Their friends go, what? You got a Rembrandt? And you go, well, I do for this weekend anyway. Hope the boss doesn't notice, right? This guy skirted off with a manuscript. The stunning thing to me is that he had one. And had he not been the curator of a museum, he wouldn't have had one. No one in the ancient world would have. They're expensive. Incredibly expensive. Ask a friend, if you have a Jewish friend, when they start a new synagogue, within 4, 5, 10 years, they'll have a separate service where they consecrate their Torah scroll, which is just a scroll of the 5 books of Moses. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Numbers. Just those 5 books. And they have a special service where they have hired someone to etch out in ink and pen on animal skin the 5 books. Not all 39 books of the Old Testament, just the first 5. Ask them what it cost. Today it's $4 to $6 million. For just 5 of the 39 books of the Old Testament. So in a manuscript culture, while you could record things and write them down, very few people had access to them. Typographic culture makes it available to everybody. And that's why there could have never been a Reformation without the printing press and without expensive paper. Because how can you hold the church accountable to the Holy Scriptures when you don't have the Holy Scriptures? So that actually changes everything. Reading now becomes a popular activity rather than a scribal activity. Most of the scribes of the ancient world and medieval world who copied texts couldn't even read the language they copied. They spoke Latin, not Greek. And they were copying Greek text and they couldn't even read them. They were trained to recognize Greek alphabets and they spent their entire day with candlelight copying down these Greek letters that they couldn't even read. They didn't know whether they were copying Aeschylus or Protagoras or St. Paul. They didn't even know. And you say, why'd they do it? Well, the alternative was mucking stables, right? And so monastery life didn't give you a lot of good options. Those are your options. But what happens with typography is all sorts of people can read and write. And as we see, what it develops is rationality. What happens with a book, a person says something on page 6. Later on page 14, you think, that seems to me different than what he said on page 6. You go back and say, it is. He did contradict himself. You can't do that with orality. All your mind's properties are developing memory, remembering what he said, not critically evaluating what he said. Once it's written down, this incredible rational process takes place in the human race as we can now pause. We can also pause and think. We're reading along and say, well, let me just think about that for a while. Let me go check the Encyclopedia Britannica on that one. Or some other book that I've read on that topic. You put a bookmark in there, right? You can't do that with oral stuff where it's dynamic and goes on. So most students of media have said there's this incredible breakthrough of human rationality simply due to the printing press. It's no surprise that the scientific revolution comes by about a century and a half after the printing press, because you couldn't have had it without the printing press. It cultivates rationality even among people who are not trying to cultivate their rationality. The mere fact that they can put a bookmark in there and go check it somewhere else cultivates a certain kind of critical reasoning ability. And that's why when the current Librarian of Congress, James Billington, visited Grove City College several years ago, had breakfast with a few of us. And those librarians of Congress are remarkable guys. They're polymaths. They've studied everything. And he's a fascinating guy in many ways. But one of the things we asked was, what was the most important invention ever? And the answer he gave to us, not two of you would even know what it is, and the two who would wouldn't understand why it was the most important. But he told us, shocked me out of my gourd, the most important thing ever invented was the codex. Now, prior to the codex, when you had animal skins and you wanted to preserve a manuscript, it was like a piece of toilet paper. It was what we call a scroll, right? You stitched one animal skin after another, and then you rolled it around a stick, and it's what you and I call a scroll. And, of course, you could record ancient wisdom that way. Now, if you have something as big as the Hebrew Bible, it's an awfully big scroll. And finding your way around it is tough. The codex is when you cut that scroll into where every page has 80 characters aligned, or 105, and then you bind them in the back. And it's what you and I think of as a book. But when the New Testament refers to a book, it means a scroll, because the codex was invented about that time. What a book allows you to do is paginate, where thought is contained in bits that you can leaf back through. And Dr. Billington thinks it was the greatest invention in the human race to bind books in the back rather than in scrolls. That's a stunning, stunning idea. I'm still not sure if I agree with him or not, because I'm not smart enough to have an opinion on someone that smart. But it's worth a consideration. I'm thinking about it. And what he's really saying is that typography then creates rationality, because you can put page numbers on something and say, is what the person says here consistent with what they said there? And even raising the question makes you a rational human being. Whereas before, the mind was merely trying to come up with a mnemonic device. Oh, the ring-tailed lemur sleeps all day, doodar, doodar. Some way of just trying to remember what the person said, and you weren't really trying to critically evaluate it. And so typography actually cultivates that. It is also private. In an oral culture, whatever you know is a community experience. When they come and read their or recite from memory their ancient creeds, you do it as a culture. With a book, you solo. Self-knowledge comes from reading a book. I read Anna Karenina, you read Anna Karenina, you read Anna Karenina. We respond in slightly different ways. And we can talk about it later. And each of us comes to some self-awareness, because as we read the same book, we experience it differently. That's very, very different. And so individuality, a culture like ours that celebrates individuality, that is a direct result of the printing press. It creates an individual world where we experience cultural wisdom as individuals. It also permits communication with those who are dead, right? One of the things that Chesterton lamented was the tyranny of living. And it was a good thing to lament, the tyranny of the living. Writing permits us to have our opinions influenced by those who are deceased, to have our wisdom informed by those who are no longer living, because what they have written is still here, even though they are not here to raise their voice and object. And so it's a wonderful cultural thing. And it also promotes analysis. Writing permits us to be incredibly clear. One of Socrates' objections to writing was, he said, if you say something, how will anyone know that you meant what you said? Because they wrote in dialogue, right? They communicated in dialogue. You say something and someone, well, did you mean this or that? And so one of his objections, his first objection was you'd lose memory. His second objection was no one would understand each other because you wouldn't be able to talk with the person who wrote. You'd have a manuscript that can't speak and answer your questions. And that's a valid concern. But what happens is once you know that you're writing for people who can't ask you questions 100 years from now, 200 years from now, you develop the ability to write, as the old minister says to the young minister, not so that someone may understand you, but that so no one will misunderstand you. Right? And so you learn all the properties of your own language and to choose exactly the right word, lest you be misunderstood. And if you use a word that's synonymous with two others, now when I say X, I don't mean Y, but I mean Z. Right? And so what Socrates didn't understand was the incredible precision that would come from writing, where people realized, I have to say this in such a precise way that people who can't ask me questions later will still get it. And that's what produced the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment and so forth, was the printing press itself, the incredible precision by which the language is made to work. And so those are kind of things that writing does. Tomorrow we're going to look at is when we move from these particularly linguistic phenomena to photographic image media and also electronic media and talk about then how they shape us. Our goal is to talk about how the very media that we experience shape us as worshipers and how to make the best of all of those media as worshipers, and to back away from some of them if they don't help us as worshipers. I mean, that's where we're ultimately going. But at some point, Pastor Reynolds and I, myself, are persuaded from what we've learned from media studies is that at some point we have to understand how those various media make us, what they're doing to us, how they're shaping us. It's not just the content in those media, but how those media make us different human beings than we would otherwise be. And so we'll pick up tomorrow morning, I think, with that and talk about a couple more before we move actually to worship per se, and then talk about, with some understanding of what these media do, how does that influence us as worshipers?